It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
I gotta start with the earthquake, or the fake quake, as I'm calling it. Yes, there was actually a 4.8 earthquake outside New York City in New Jersey. The amount of cable coverage that this generated was embarrassing because nothing happened as a result. Is it interesting? Is it noteworthy? Should it be reported? Sure. But soon we were into almost wall-to-wall coverage. I mean, CNN started it, and then everybody else jumped on the bandwagon. And I never saw even a single broken window. I never saw a single injured person. I heard people talking about, well, the wine glasses were shaking in my kitchen or in my hotel room. And on and on and on it went. So obviously, this earthquake didn't have much impact. But the lengths to which the anchors and correspondents were going to keep this thing alive. One family was rounded up. They were from out of town. They'd stayed in a, I don't know, New York hotel room. You know, mom, dad, and a couple of kids. Two of the people said, oh, they definitely felt movement. The other two who were lying on the bed said, oh, yeah, we didn't feel anything. We weren't even aware of it. That's the length to which it went. Now, I ask you, if this had not happened adjacent to New York City, where all of the television networks and the big media organizations are headquartered, would this have gotten more than 10 minutes of coverage if it had happened, you know, in Arizona? Or Washington State, or Florida, or parts of California, and there was no damage? I mean, people in California who have to deal with real earthquakes were laughing at this. Like, what? I just was stunned by how much airtime was devoted to the fake quake. Now, today, there's going to be a real event, the eclipse. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's not going to happen again for another, I don't know, 30 years or something like that. What amazes me here is that so many people are flocking to areas where the eclipse will be most total, or where it'll be darkest, like Buffalo, where I went to college. That, for example, the Buffalo Niagara area has had to declare a state of emergency. I mean, on the one hand, you think, well, it's good for tourism, right? That all the hotel rooms get booked. But I'm just stunned that people are so into this that they would, you know, make a trip out of it. But that's great, you know, fine. We'll see how it goes. I also got to talk about the women's basketball final. I actually did a report on Fox News Sunday yesterday. And by the way, I hope you had a good weekend. Hope you had a chance to see Media Buzz. We talked about this as well just before the final championship game. And, you know, I was disappointed because I was rooting for Caitlin Collins in Iowa. She is the most phenomenal player I've seen in a very long time, male or female. And she got out to this horrid start. 18 first quarter points, dropping threes. And yet, I was not confident at all because, first of all, I figured she's not going to score 18 points every quarter. And secondly, as with many of the other teams that Iowa has faced, South Carolina, which had an undefeated season, and congratulations to South Carolina, which won fairly easily in the end, just has a bigger, stronger team, including the 6'7 center, Cardoza, who I don't think is the world's greatest athlete and missed a whole lot of foul shots, but nobody could guard her. I mean, and so naturally, South Carolina was getting 2 and 3 rebounds on missed shots, second chance points, third chance points. And Iowa had sort of a mini comeback in the third quarter. Caitlin Collins hit a couple of shots. But what happened is South Carolina's defense, I think, was just too good and their superior size. And then, and I don't know if this was pressure or what, but by the third quarter and beginning of the fourth quarter, Iowa just went totally cold. Caitlin couldn't hit any shots. I mean, I'm not talking about like throwing them up desperation shots. She had her look. She had the three-point shots she usually drains. And they were clanking off the rim. And she would pass to others and they would miss the shots. You can't have everybody on the team go cold at the same time, especially when the other team is getting 2 or 3 shots at the basket. So in that sense, it was disappointing. But in a larger sense, this has utterly transformed women's basketball. It got more attention than the men's NCAA playoffs. And I think that's great. The question now is, will it carry over once now Angel Reese of LSU, which lost that a Friday night nail-biter to Iowa. That was a great game. And that shattered the previous record set by Iowa and LSU. More than 14 million people watched a women's basketball game. But with Caitlin going into the WNBA, with Angel Reese going to the WNBA, I don't know. Does it fade? Does it need to be another star of Caitlin Clark's magnitude? We shall see. I made a bit of news on Media Buzz, a little surprising to me, and it was pegged to this post, this Truth Social post that Donald Trump put up, attacking Judge Juan Merchan in the hush money case, the only one of the four criminal cases, actually starts next Monday, that will be heard and presumably have a verdict, compared to the much more important and less openly partisan cases. So Trump writes, "Now we have Merchan, who is not allowing me to talk, thereby violating the law and the Constitution all at once. It is so bad what he's trying to get away with. How was he even chosen for this case?" And here's the key part. "If this partisan hack wants to put me in the clink for speaking the open and obvious truth, I will gladly become a modern-day Nelson Mandela. It will be my great honor." So I had on the Trump campaign's national press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, and I said, I read that key passage, and I said, "Why is he comparing himself to Mandela? And is he now worried that he could wind up in jail as a result of this case?" And she said, "Oh, the case was terrible and it never should have been brought and it was totally partisan." And she just ripped the case, which is fine. But she didn't answer. She said he wasn't worried about going to jail because, although he's the one who raised the prospect, because ultimately they would win the case. And she didn't address the Mandela part at all. Now, we were over time at that point. I really wanted to come back and say, what about Mandela? Clearly, she didn't want to answer the part of that part of the question. But I did say, in reference to the tougher gag order, which include Judge Merchan's daughter and also DA Alvin Bragg's daughter, I did say, well, he is allowed to talk about the case, which is true. It's not that he can't talk about the case at all. He just can't make statements that could be seen as attacking or intimidating witnesses, court personnel, or now the family members of court personnel. He can still attack the judge, as he did. He can still attack Democrat Alvin Bragg, which he did. Anyway, this was written up Newsweek, HuffPost, Mediaite. I guess because I'm the only person who brought it up, but certainly not because I got an answer to that question. All right, story number one. Early this morning, I saw the video that Donald Trump made. It's about a 5-minute video in which he announced his position on abortion. I'd asked about that yesterday too, but it was said that he would do it this week, and he did. And here's the thing. after the interview with me, in which Trump said he wanted to devise an abortion compromise that would make everyone happy, I said I didn't think that was possible. He didn't dispute a New York Times report that he was talking to advisors about banning the procedure after 16 weeks. A couple days later, he said 15 weeks in another interview. But in this video, you know, Trump said he wanted to make everybody happy. I would say maybe he didn't make anybody unhappy because essentially he just embraced the status quo. He said the states should decide, both voters and lawmakers, depending on how each state handles it. And he said some would set more conservative limits and others would set looser ones. No mention of any time limits. He didn't even say second trimester. Because I don't think that would have made everybody happy because on the one hand, 15 weeks or so, given this environment, wouldn't have made pro-choicers happy, but seemed like a reasonable compromise. But I think pro-life groups particularly would say, look, 94% of abortions are done before the second trimester, and so you really haven't done much to reduce abortion. So he took credit, as he's entitled to do, for appointing three of the six conservative justices that got rid of Roe v. Wade a couple of years ago with the argument that states would decide. And whether Trump had made this statement or not made the statement, that's exactly what will happen. The states will decide. He also, as he did in his interview with me, said that Democrats are the radicals here because they won't oppose late-term abortion. And then he went into this business about executing babies after they're born, which had to do with some comments, later walked back by former Virginia Democratic Governor Ralph Northam, which we got into as well. So, look, critics are going to say, well, he ducked it. He didn't really take a stand. He's leaving it up to the states. I mean, Florida, after a court ruling there, and I raised this yesterday, now has a six-week ban, or will have by May 1st, pushed through by Governor Ron DeSantis. I thought maybe Trump would say that's too harsh, but no, he's decided to embrace the idea that the states will decide. And it's the safest political path, but clearly a lot of critics will accuse him of ducking the issue, making no reference whatever, even to saying, you know, I certainly think the second trimester is too late, didn't go there. That was the decision he made. But, you know, it's classic Trump in the sense that by talking about 16 weeks and by talking about 15 weeks, he very clearly signaled what he prefers. And now when he makes the, air quotes, official announcement, doesn't make any reference to it, but he did with a wink and a nod kind of indicate to people on all sides of the debate what his own personal stance would be. He just didn't sort of, again, make it the policy. And he started out that video by talking about IVF and how he's strongly in favor of in vitro fertilization. And he didn't like what the court ruled in Alabama, but the Alabama lawmakers, I guess, took care of it. And that's smart politics, too. I know there was a debate about leftover embryos and whether that is unacceptable to the pro-life movement. But Trump knows it's popular and he has a good nose for these things. Separately, there was this huge fundraiser in Palm Beach Saturday night. And as I reported and others reported, Donald Trump is said to have raised $50 million. This was held in Palm Beach at the sort of palatial home of a hedge fund billionaire. And the number hasn't been verified, but let's say it's true. It cost a lot of money to get into this thing. That would be twice as much money as the $25 million that Joe Biden raised with the help of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. I mean, that was eye-popping enough in itself. And if it's anything near $50 million, I mean, it's a win for Trump, not just with the bragging rights, not just because he did it without any former presidents, other former presidents, but because this money, which will be split with the RNC, helps him in his own fundraising, which has been lagging. John Paulson is the name of the billionaire fundraiser. But now the New York Times reports this, that what he said privately, and by the way, Melania was there, and now she seems like she's stepping into the campaign after she'd been sort of MIA, that Trump told the participants that people are not immigrating to the United States from, quote, nice countries, quote, like Denmark. He went on to say, again, according to this Times report, he seemed to make a reference to, remember the whole flap about when he talked about Haiti and some African nations as S-hole countries? I mean, that was a pretty intense controversy. And when I said, you know, and he's referencing this, why can't we allow people to come in from nice countries? And I'm trying to be nice. Nice countries, you know, like Denmark, Switzerland. Do we have any people coming in from Denmark? How about Switzerland? How about Norway? And, you know, they took it as a very terrible comment, but I felt it was fine. And then he talked about, you know, people coming in. I mean, you've heard him say this many times, not only from these other countries, but from hospitals and insane asylums. I don't think they're on this island, but I know they're on that island right there. That's West Palm. He was in Palm Beach, pointing across the water. Congratulations over there. But they'll be here. Eventually, they'll be here. So this, the town of Palm Beach, where Paulson's estate is overlooking the water, needless to say, a very wealthy community, 93.8% white. In West Palm Beach, about a third of residents are black and about a quarter are Hispanic. So obviously people are going to see racial overtones. Oh, Norway's fine, Denmark's fine, but not the SO countries and not some of the countries that are most troubling. Now, there is no hard evidence that crime is doubling because of illegal migrants, although they commit a crime by coming here. There's no question about it.
Hey, let's pause right there. The Buzz Meter continues right after this.
The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
All right, let's move on to number 2 and the current president. Biden is now racing to tell voters about his accomplishments in ways big and small. So far, it's not working very well. In fact, when Frank Luntz was on Media Buzz, and these segments are online, he said if the election were tomorrow, Trump would win. He said the reason that Biden is scoring so low on all kinds of ability to handle this, whether it's the economy, whether it's honest and trustworthy, whether it's effectively managing government, is all about his age. He said his age, his age, his age. And he cast doubt on Joe Biden's ability to catch up, noting, and he said this is not often pointed out by the press compared to coverage of Trump struggling with suburban women, that he's actually almost tied for Latinos. That is an absolute sea change for a Republican candidate to be doing that well. And meanwhile, he's also doing well. Trump is also doing well, according to Luntz, with rank and file union members as opposed to the leadership. And meanwhile, Biden is struggling with black voters, some of whom may vote for Trump or, more likely in my view, just stay home. And that is obviously a key part of the Biden coalition. All right, circling back to this New York Times story. So there were signs going up at construction projects financed by the infrastructure bill that Biden got passed, or created by the $280 billion CHIPS Act. Biden has put his name on emails telling Americans with student debt that their loans were being forgiven. There's a new effort now to do this for many younger voters. But here's Democratic Governor Phil Murphy of New Jersey, who I guess survived the earthquake, Democrats have traditionally been the party of the abstract, says Murphy, and we need to be the party that humanizes things. He, Biden personally, is so good at this, putting his arm figuratively and literally around the American people and saying, hey, listen, I feel your pain. And yet, most Americans in polls disapprove of the 81-year-old president's performance. And, you know, the more Biden talks about past laws he passed, I guess laws that he passed in the first 2 years before the Republicans narrowly took over the House, you know, it just starts to sound like old news, and it does sound abstract. Now, it's not abstract if you go to, I believe he's going to Wisconsin today to talk about some of this. And, you know, you get local headlines. That's great. But it doesn't seem to be breaking through, and that is the admission of this Time story. So Trump can talk about, look, when I was in office, we cut taxes, we reshaped the Supreme Court, and whether people like that or not, it helps him drive turnout among his base. Now, the piece goes on to say, of course, Biden's investments in infrastructure and manufacturing are already creating jobs, but most of the jobs will be created in the future. Now, Biden's trying to humanize things. In Michigan, he was showing off his putting skills with a black pastor. North Carolina, he sat down with a former school principal who had his student loans forgiven. It's all about storytelling. He went to a guy's grocery business, which stayed afloat during the pandemic, thanks to aid from Biden's COVID legislation. But, you know, that feels like a long time ago. Here's a perfect example. In Milwaukee, the president visited the site of a $36 million road improvement project that will try to repair the destructive legacy of a highway rooted through African-American neighborhoods in the 1960s. It's scheduled to finish in 2029, which would be after Biden's second term if he won. All right. I want to turn to the Middle East. A lot going on there. Let's dive right in. Story three. When the Israel-Hamas war broke out 6 months ago, says Politico, it represented the kind of global crisis that President Biden said that he has the great experience to confront. You know, former vice president, former chairman of foreign relations. But as the U.S. struggled to prevent the conflict from spiraling into a humanitarian catastrophe, which is roughly where we are now, some of Biden's close advisors and allies began worrying that rather than bolstering his image as an experienced global leader, the president's steadfast support for Israel's offensive risked further complicating his argument that the election is a choice between his moral clarity and Trump's chaos. Here's Bernie Sanders. Here's Tim Kaine, you know, Democratic senators, saying, well, this is a political problem. Here's a former foreign policy advisor to Bernie named Matt Duss. It has undermined one of his, Biden's, most important assets against Trump. Biden's reputation was, agree or disagree with him, he's a decent guy, he's an empathetic guy, he's an honest guy. But this policy has been a cruel policy. Tim Kaine, former VP nominee. Biden's current approach is not working. Now, this is interesting, and this is news from the Washington Post. When Biden proposed an additional $24 billion for Ukraine, Moscow spin doctors, this is sort of the disinformation campaign, working for the Kremlin, ready to undermine public support. According to internal Kremlin documents, listen to this. They try to influence congressional and other debates, stoke anti-Ukraine sentiment. Kremlin-linked political strategists and trolls have written thousands of fabricated news articles, social media posts, and comments that promote American isolationism, stir fear over the United States' border security, and attempt to amplify U.S. economic and racial tensions, according to these documents reviewed by the Washington Post. This is exactly what the Kremlin, it's not exactly, but it is the same interference in our internal politics that the Kremlin tried to do and did do in 2016. So one strategist instructed a troll farm employee to write a comment of no more than 200 characters in the name of a resident of a suburb of a major city. This would be made up. This fictitious American, quote, doesn't support the military aid the U.S. is giving Ukraine and considers that the money should be spent defending America's borders and not Ukraine's, which is certainly an argument that many Republicans make. He sees that Biden's policies are leading the U.S. toward collapse. More than 100 documents reviewed by the Post. 2022-2023. Meanwhile, a whole lot is being made about the fact that the Israeli military announcing over the weekend it has withdrawn a division from southern Gaza. This as the war reached, tragically, the six-month mark. And this major army division is going to recuperate and prepare for future operations. And so a lot of people, oh, Biden's policy is working. Biden said Bibi had to change course. He had to reduce civilian casualties. He has to get more humanitarian aid to starving Palestinians, innocent families, including obviously children. However, I don't see this as a huge turning point. I see this just as a tactical move because the Netanyahu government still says it's going to invade Rafah. Million and a half people there, densely populated. They want to finish off Hamas. Whether that's physically possible or not, I don't know. Biden people warning that a ground invasion would be catastrophic. But he hasn't really changed course. And listen to this. Nancy Pelosi signed a letter on Friday from dozens of congressional Democrats, most of them left-wingers, to the president and Tony Blinken, urging a halt to weapons transfers to Israel. The Hamas estimate, even if it's inflated, more than 33,000 people have died in the war. So for Nancy Pelosi to stop the, argue for the stopping the transfer of weapons, which is hung up on Capitol Hill anyway, but I think Biden's found a way around it, comes after, also, I guess, includes a call for the administration to conduct its own probe into that horrible, tragic Israeli airstrike that killed seven members of Jose Andres World Central Kitchen. Humanitarians who were trying to provide food to the people of Gaza. And, you know, look, Rashida Tlaib, AOC, were among the 36 other Democrats that signed this. Unjustifiable to approve these weapons transfers. Another way of pressuring Israel. And back to Ukraine. Now that Russia is stepping up airstrikes against Ukraine, Vladimir Zelensky's options for what to do next range from bad to worse in the assessment of the Washington Post. Zelensky has said Ukraine will accept nothing less than the return of all its territory, including the land that Russia seized in 2014. But it's a stalemate. Ukrainians are dying on the battlefield every single day. They do not have enough ammunition or soldiers. Although there's a big thing about their lowering the age, the draft age, but it was lowered from something like 26 or 27. So it's not like they're, you know, drafting teenagers. That was actually a pretty high age. How will Zelensky get out of this situation? I have no idea, said a Ukrainian lawmaker. And Donald Trump has said privately, this is another Post story, that he could end Russia's war in Ukraine by pressuring Ukraine to give up some territory. Many experts, analysts saying Trump's idea would reward Putin and condone the violation of seizing land in a sovereign nation by force. Trump's proposal, again, this is, he hasn't said this publicly, to cede Crimea, which was seized in 2014, and the Donbass border region to Russia, according to people who have discussed it with Trump. This is sort of like the abortion compromise, except he hasn't said it publicly. And now he has talked about abortion publicly as of this morning. Privately, Trump says he thinks both Russia and Ukraine want to save face. They want a way out. Accepting Russian control over parts of Ukraine would expand the reach of Putin's dictatorship. Biggest land war in Europe since World War II. Now, here's Lindsey Graham, longtime foreign policy hawk, quoted as saying the following. I've been spending 100% of my time talking to Trump about Ukraine. He has to pay a price, meaning Putin. He can't win at the end of this.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
All right, story four. RFK Jr. has really screwed this up. He said Friday that if he was elected, he would, which is not going to happen, he would appoint a special counsel to investigate how prosecutors handled the January 6th cases. You know, it sounds good. Let's have an investigation. He said Friday there was little evidence of a true insurrection and that the protesters at the Capitol carried no weapons. Okay, the reality, more than 1,000 people have been charged in the attack, including 10 on gun-related charges. So he had to put out another statement saying, I was wrong about the guns. My understanding that none of the January 6th rioters who invaded the Capitol were carrying firearms was incorrect. So he also had referred to the J6 defendants as activists, which is sort of echoing the Trumpian language about hostages. He said the protest turned into a riot. He's just all over the map. And what's happening now is, now that it is really beyond dispute that Bobby Kennedy's son, opposed by most of the Kennedy family, is going to play the role of spoiler, is going to probably draw far more votes from Biden than Trump, he's getting more media scrutiny. In the past, he would say stuff about vaccines or whatever, and it wouldn't make that much of an impact. So, by the way, they not only brought guns, they brought pepper spray, bear spray, flagpoles, fire extinguishers. More than 140 police officers were injured. I mean, just in case you forgot what happened on that tragic day in the Capitol. And finally, story five. This has to do with whole lot of resignations on Capitol Hill. Story begins by saying that House Majority Steve Scalise thought he had a good argument for Congressman Mike Gallagher. Gallagher from Wisconsin had announced he was going to leave Congress, one of 21 Republicans who said they're heading for the exits. But three Republicans who had previously announced their intention to leave had reconsidered now they were going to stay. So Scalise made that point. Scalise said, I know. I said, you know, it's not too late for you. I'm not going to give up working on him. But it hasn't worked. Gallagher is going to retire earlier than expected, leaving the House with a one vote majority. Some dispute the math, but it's razor thin. However, when Kevin McCarthy's successor is picked, it would go back to two or however you want to do the math. So what the Washington Post is telling us is that this is reaffirmed for most of those departing members that they made the right call to leave because the House has become more partisan. Okay, duh. It's more difficult to pass legislation that makes an impact than when some of these folks were first elected, and a broader drop in morale within the GOP conference. As you can tell from Marjorie Taylor Greene saying she's going to try to remove Speaker Mike Johnson. Although she didn't make it a privilege resolution, which means she can bring it up at any time. She may not bring it up at any time. But members are also worried that some lawmakers who already decided to leave will again resign early. For example, former Congressman Ken Buck of Colorado, resigned after condemning how unserious his party has become, has hinted that several additional colleagues are thinking about leaving before the new year. "This is a dysfunctional place," said Buck, "and I'm not making an observation that others haven't made." So, five of the 21 retiring Republicans will leave before the end of the term. By the way, a bunch of Democrats have also announced they're leaving. Eight lawmakers retiring from the Energy and Commerce Committee. Eight subcommittee chairs are leaving. Four former members of a different GOP leadership era also quitting. Kevin McCarthy, obviously, after he was stripped of his speakership. His deputy Patrick McHenry, who briefly filled in during the chaos of trying to find a new speaker. Former deputy whip Drew Ferguson and McMorris Rogers. So, what's happened is, like, you know, when you ask the question, what have the Republicans accomplished? Well, they've trotted out a bunch of hearings to impeach Joe Biden. That looks like it's not going to happen. Instead, there'll be a referral to DOJ that will probably be ignored. And you can see why people get frustrated. I mean, Congress has always been a difficult place, especially when there are tight majorities, to navigate, to get bipartisan consensus, particularly in this era when cooperating with the other party, as Mike Johnson has been forced to do to avoid yet another government shutdown that doesn't make anybody happy, to get things done. And it's the same thing that tripped up McCarthy. In order to get elected speaker, he agreed to essentially have a rhetorical, or I guess I should say procedural, gun pointed at his head. Any one member could call for a vote of no confidence, in effect. That's what MTG is now doing with Mike Johnson. Same issues. And remember, McCarthy got every vote in the Republican caucus except eight. I talked to Nancy Mace about this. She was one of the eight. And she still blames him. And she blames him also for resigning early, saying this started the trend. Whatever fingers you want to point, it's clear that the institution is kind of coming apart at the seams. And that this would probably be the least productive Congress in a very long time. And that will enable the Democrats, you know, have their own set of problems, to say, look, you gave them the majority. Look what they did with it. They did nothing for you. And now Mike Johnson wants a compromise on Ukraine aid, which would be very good for Ukraine, in my view, good for America, for Europe, for not letting Putin get away with this unprovoked and brutal invasion that has frequently targeted civilians. But it will not make him any more popular in the Republican caucus. So once again, hope you enjoyed your weekend. The things I talked about you can find online. Media Buzz segments and others. And I'll just take a little break now and pause with this pre-recorded announcement. I will see you tomorrow with more BuzzMeter.
Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.